I promise you that some of this is going to sound strangely familiar, because we're going to see a makeup test with virtually, not exactly, but virtually identical circumstances. And the first test, the disciples flunked. All of them did. I personally am so grateful that God gives makeup tests. I wouldn't be here if he didn't. If God just said, good luck, buddy, you got one shot at it, you don't do it right, that's it, you know, hit the showers, I would not be here. So I'm grateful for makeup tests, which are not for God's benefit, they're for our benefit, so that we have an opportunity to do correctly and learn from what we did incorrectly and to learn from our mistakes. And I just love that about God. And I have to tell you that not a lot of church people even know that that's true. And there needs to be more of an examination of Jesus's heart and what he does. That's why we do what we do here, why we spend so much time studying. So the good news is this is a makeup test for the disciples, part of this passage today. The bad news is they flunked this one also. They did eventually get it. As hard as it is to believe, as many times as the clue bus circled the block for these guys before they actually climbed on, they actually did eventually climb on and learn, and that gives me great hope as well. So we'll begin reading chapter 8. We'll get about as far as verse 21 this morning, hopefully. But we're not in a hurry. I'll begin reading at verse 1, chapter 8. It starts out with the words, during those days, in my NIV. So that's one of those connected phrases that, you know, for those of you that weren't here, or if you've forgotten where we're in a region called the Decapolis, which is mostly Gentiles. Decapolis meaning 10 cities, large area of bordering what were then the borders of Israel. If the name sounds familiar, it's where Jesus made a special trip to cast a bunch of demons out of one guy. And then Jesus was asked to leave. And he left a missionary who had about 15 minutes worth of knowledge. And he left a missionary, and I find it so remarkable, the results from that one guy going back to his people, and all he knew to tell them was what Jesus had done for him. And so during those days, listen to these next three words. Another large crowd gathered. Can one person make a difference? Yes, it can. Since they had nothing to eat, you should write the word yet in there, because the word in Greek it doesn't mean they didn't ever have anything to eat. It just means they ran out. So I'm going to read it that way. Since they had nothing left to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I have compassion for these people. Literally, my heart goes out to these people. They've already been with me 3 days and they have nothing left to eat, same word again. And if I send them home hungry, they'll collapse on the way, because some of them have come a long distance. And I always wondered, how did he know that? And his disciples answered, please, this is the flunking. This sound you hear is the flunking of the test, the same test, second time. How many years did you spend in the third grade? It's that kind of a deal. The disciples answered, but where in this remote place can anyone get enough bread to feed them? How clueless can you be? They just saw this happen. I think you should underline the word this, because I think there's a clue as to why it was so hard for them to factor Jesus into the equation. It had to do with where they were. How many loaves do you have? Jesus asked. 7, they replied. He told the crowd to sit down on the ground, and when he had taken the 7 loaves and given thanks, underline that, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people. Those are both continuous action verb tenses in Greek. So he kept on giving them for the disciples to keep on setting them before the people. So that's where the miracle took place. And they had a few small fish as well, and so he gave thanks for them also. That's a different word than the one in verse 6. Gave thanks for them also and told the disciples to distribute them. The people ate and were, the Greek word is very rude, they were glutted. They were stuffed, you know, like we were when we were watching the Patriots game on Thanksgiving, filled with tryptophan. And that was a good dinner, by the way. Thank you, Fred and Nancy. People ate and were glutted. Afterward, the disciples picked up 7 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. You might want to underline that word basketfuls, because it's a different word than we saw in chapter 6 when Jesus fed 5,000 people and there were 12 baskets left over. Different word. The word is for a hamper. I'm going to say it that way because it's a lot of food. Picked up 7 hampers of broken pieces that were left over. About 4,000 men were present. Remember, the Jews did not number women and children when there was a mixed crowd. They only numbered the men. And having sent them away, he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the region of Dalmanutha, which is vaguely west. The Pharisees came and began to question Jesus. That's a highly sanitized verb. It literally means to browbeat. Any of you remember Perry Mason? Any of you old enough to remember the Perry Mason? It's Ironside before the wheelchair, sort of. Yeah. Any of you remember Ironside? Okay, Perry Mason. Remember Hamilton Burger? Hamburger, the prosecuting attorney, how he used to browbeat people. That's what this word is. This is the word for a severe browbeating cross-examination. So these, why is that important, Bob? Because these are not guys looking for the truth. Churches are still filled with people that love to argue, and they're not interested in the truth. They just like to argue. The Pharisees came and began to literally browbeat Jesus. To test him, they asked him for a sign from heaven, and the phrase from heaven is the operative pivotal word in that sentence. He sighed deeply, or he groaned deeply, and said, "Why does this generation ask for a miraculous sign?" And I would have you underline the word "this generation." That's important to understanding this passage. I tell you the truth, no sign will be given to it. And Matthew adds, in Matthew chapter 16, in Matthew's account of this, Jesus added the phrase, "except the sign of Jonah." Remember Jonah in the belly of the fish, 3 days and 3 nights. I tell you the truth, no sign will be given it. And then Matthew, "except the sign of Jonah." And then he left them, and he got into the boat and crossed to the other side. So that's back east. The disciples had, now this is sort of stage directions. I don't know if you've ever been in a play. This first phrase that Mark gives us is the setup for why this next event, this next vignette happened. Parenthetically, the disciples had forgotten to bring bread, except for 1 loaf that they had with them in the boat. Okay, that's the stage directions. "Be careful," Jesus warned them. "Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod," and then Matthew adds, "the Sadducees." So the Pharisees, Herodians, and Sadducees, and we'll talk about what that means. They discussed this with one another, and they said, you notice this is one of those things that guys do. It's sort of like not asking for directions. You don't want to look stupid. So what you do is, they didn't just ask Jesus, what are you talking about? How hard would that have been? But they didn't want him to know that they didn't know what he was talking about. So they just sort of, pss, what do you think he was talking about? Kind of thing. With chickens, they were. We never do stuff like that, do we? They discussed this with one another and said, it's because we have no bread. Aware of their discussion. See, that doesn't pay to try to hide stuff from Jesus, because he knows what you're talking about. Jesus asked them why. See, personally, in the Bob version of this, in the Bob movie version of this, where I'm the director, Jesus is right on the edge. He is at that point of frustration that every parent understands completely. You've repeated yourself so many times, one more time, it's like Popeye saying, that's all I can stand, and I can't stand no more. You know, that's the way I see Jesus. And his pipe is just about to start flipping around, and smoke's going to be coming out of his ears. Why are you talking about having no bread? This is not about bread. Do you still not see or understand? That's a powerful word, the word understand. Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see, and ears but fail to hear? And don't you remember? If I could pick a title other than the one I picked, it would be Don't You Remember, because that's one of the biggest reasons we worry about stuff. We just don't remember. We don't connect the dots between what God's done before, where we are. So Jesus on the edge says, don't you remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many basketfuls of pieces you picked up? 12, they replied, looking down, 12. And when I broke the 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up?
7,
he answered. And he said to them, this is another continuous action verb in Greek. The English just misses the point. He said over and over, do you still not understand? Now, lest we end on a depressing note, in Matthew 16 and verse 12, it says that at this point, when they realized they had just flunked the same test for the second time, Jesus explained to them what he was talking about originally when he said, be on your guard about the yeast of the Pharisees, the Herodians, and the Sadducees, and those wonderful words, Matthew 16:12, it says, and then they did understand. So, a lot of stuff in here. Let's rewind back up to verse 1 and show you my notes. Lots of little sticky appendages and lots of good stuff in here. There are some, I was going to call them theologians, but I'm not sure that I would call them theologians. They're just critics. They're people that take the Bible and try to, you know, pick it apart. And many of them start from the position that it's not true, which is not pure science, is it? When you start out with a postulate already, you start out with a convinced opinion about something, you're going to put a spin on whatever evidence that you don't like, whatever evidence that you do like, and that's the way some theologians are. They start out believing, first of all, God doesn't do supernatural things. I think if you can get past Genesis 1:1, the very first verse in the Bible, if you can get past that, you're not going to have any trouble with the whole rest of the Bible. If you can believe that out of nothing, God created everything, thought it up, put it together, holds it together, then pretty much the rest of it is going to be easy. But to be fair and to keep my brain open, I read these guys. And sometimes it's hilarious, the explanations that they have. It would be harder to believe the stuff that they say than to just believe that God did a miracle. And some of those people have said that this event that Mark describes in chapter 8 is the same event in chapter 6, the feeding of the 5,000, and that just Mark just forgot the numbers and got it messed up. And of course, if you don't study, and if you start from a certain skewed point of view to begin with, that would be easy to, at a cursory glance, to draw those conclusions. But there are a number of details that are different. I'll point them out to you in case you ever talk to somebody that that doesn't understand that principle. But the biggest explanation that this was two separate events, the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000 here, is that Jesus himself says that he did it twice. One is in Galilee, where all the wildfires have been, if you've been watching the news. One was in literally their home territory. Isn't it interesting? They flunked the test in their home territory. And that is one of the reasons why when now in Gentile territory, in hostile territory, remember the last time that they'd been in this area, Jesus got kicked out of town. People didn't like them. They didn't like the people. And so it's not really a wonder that they flunked the test again. So there were different areas, but there are a lot of differences between these two accounts, and I'm a detail kind of a guy. So I'll try to point them out to you if you're interested in that. And that's partially why we're studying. But first, before we get any farther than the first verse, I want to say what I said last week. Never underestimate the power and effectiveness of a satisfied customer. First rule of good advertising: nothing beats a satisfied customer when it comes to an endorsement. All the theory in the world, all the, well, I am not a doctor, but I play a doctor on television, kinds of endorsement type stuff that we see. Nothing beats a satisfied customer. And you remember the story the last time Jesus was here. He traveled through a life-threatening storm to reach one person who was so captive. This guy was the textbook case of what Satan's agenda for humans is. This is a man who was in complete bondage to evil. People were afraid of him. He was afraid of himself. He hated himself. Covered with scars where he would cut himself to inflict pain. A complete captive. And Jesus went across through a storm to set him free. It took one word. It was virtually effortless for Jesus to reach this guy. And the demons begged Jesus for mercy. And remember the story, they were cast into a herd of pigs, which was an illegal cash crop. In any Israeli territory, it was illegal to raise pigs. So despite the fact that there were Gentiles in that region, there were also Jews in that region, and they did not want to draw attention. It could be that the reason the Jews were raising the pigs in Gentile territory is that, the long arm of the law might not reach that far. But at any rate, they didn't want any unwarranted attention. And so they asked Jesus to leave. And Jesus will always leave where he's not wanted. He will not force himself on people. Makes me a little bit afraid of the way our posture that our country has. Because if we say we get out of here, he will. And there are enough people saying, please, please don't get out of here, and trying to bring him into bear in every situation that he's here. But it's not because of our goodness. It's because of his faithfulness. So despite the fact that Jesus was asked to leave, he left a missionary. We said last week this was the most untrained missionary possibly in all of history. He'd spent, 15, 20 minutes with Jesus? He knew no theology. He hadn't been to any classes. All he knew was he used to hate himself. He used to be an absolute captive to the forces of evil. And in a word, Jesus set him free. And he begged Jesus, please, can I go with you? They don't want you here. Please, I don't want to stay here. Please let me go with you. He was asking sort of to go to Bible college, if you want to put it in one respect. He said, I just want to hang out with you. And Jesus said, no. I want you to stay here. I want you to go to your people. And I want you to tell him what God has done for you. Put yourself in his place. What if there were no other Christians here where you live, where you work? Some of you, it's true, there aren't any other Christians where you work. What if you're the only one and you think, I know nothing. I didn't take any courses. I mean, I sort of felt a little bit like that when God asked me to come to Maine, and I had been here before, and I thought, they don't like Christians here. They don't particularly like people from away. So, I mean, why, what good could I possibly do? And he said the same thing to me that he said to this guy. He said, just tell people what Jesus has done for you. And, of course, the more that you know him and the more you walk with him, the more you have to tell. This guy was very ill-equipped. And I just love that last week and this week we see large crowds of people. Mark says here in verse 1, another large crowd, meaning that there had been more than one. And in this crowd, there was at least 4,000 men, which there could have been three times that many people if you include women and children. One guy who knew hardly anything. And the next time Jesus shows up in his region, people are coming to Jesus. That's the exact opposite of chasing Jesus away, isn't it? You find anything hopeful in that? Boy, I do. I remember when I first got here 14 years ago, and I remember I didn't even really know what I was going to be doing. I just knew the Lord moved me here. I had no idea I was going to be a pastor. I didn't want to be a pastor. I've been there before. Didn't completely trust people. And I remember every morning getting up with my French roast coffee, sitting there in East Booth Bay looking out over the water and thinking, okay, what do I do today? Lord, show me what to do today. And he would say the same thing every morning. For almost 3 years, he said the same thing every morning. He said, be a guy that loves Jesus that lives in this town. Do that when you go to the dump, which for me was several times a day, making withdrawals, not necessarily deposits. He said, when you go to the gas station, when you go to Hannaford, be a guy that loves Jesus. Oh, what good will that do? But see, you got to leave that up to Jesus, because he may have just planted you right where you are. I was thinking about that about you, Sue, about your feeling like that. What a hard place that was. But it, you may someday in eternity realize that there were some people that only saw anything of what Jesus could do in their life through that time that you were there, hard as it was. That's always true. Here's a guy, hostile territory. People didn't want Jesus around. What does he have to say? You remember hearing, you know, he waltzes into one of the 10 cities and he says, do you remember hearing rumors about some guy covered with scars, some crazy man? Everybody was afraid to go near him. They said, yeah, we saw a movie about that guy. I think Stephen King wrote a book about him. I think, you know, yeah, he was, what a scary guy. And this guy says, that was me.